listening to an episode from Tales from the First Tee. I'm your host, Rich Easton, telling tales from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. In this week, another solo cast, I share my thoughts on the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am and the PIF Saudi International, which attracted more top 20 world-ranked players than the AT&T this year. But for me, the AT&T Pro-Am is where it was at. Picking the brain of Billy the Kid, a golfer who has shot over 300 rounds of golf in 2021 and continues to shoot his age or below. But first, after a resounding feedback from last week's episode, here's another segment of This Week in the News, or Is It Just Noise? Let's start with the big rocks first. That's sometime early in my first career in sales and marketing. I was sitting in a room with 1,000 sycophants just watching our CEO perform this demonstration. And I was a little taken back by it. So later in my career, I perform it, not sitting in front of all these sycophants. So it certainly didn't get the resounding applause that our CEO got. And here was the demonstration. He went up, he had this white coat on and these safety goggles because safety was the number one thing at our company. And up on stage, he had these 2 5-gallon clear containers. And then next to them, he had these 2 equal piles of large stones, pebbles, and sand. And so he goes to the first container and he goes in and he puts in the big rocks. He puts in the pebbles, he puts in the sand, and he's able to fill up the entire container with all 3. Then he goes to the other one, and first he puts in the sand, then he puts in the pebbles. But by the time he goes to put in the big rocks, they didn't fit because the sand and the pebbles filled up more than half of the box, leaving no room for him to put in the bigger rocks. So the CEO says, when faced with problem solving, first address the biggest issue first. Those are the ones that either make you or cost you the most. Then address the other things. And if for some reasons you don't get to the other things, you're still ahead of the game. So the summary is handle big things first, because when you get them out of the way, then you could handle the little things and there's just less damage. In recent times, I've heard the expression, eat the frog first. And the first time I heard it, I'm like, could you explain that to me, please? If faced with the dilemma of having to eat a frog before or after your favorite meal, get the worst part of your experience out of the way. Eat that frog so you could go on to enjoy what you like to do. So let's start by eating the frog first. Coach Brian Flores, ex-Miami Dolphins coach, sued the NFL for racial discrimination.
Yo! Yo, holy shit, he did!
Now, I'm not going to bore those of you who know the background in this situation, nor am I going to take sides on whether or not there is discrimination at the head coach level in the NFL. I mean, just the sheer numbers by themselves would suggest that black head coaches are underrepresented compared to assistant coaches and compared to the number of black players. The job of a head coach in the NFL is only partially a meritocracy. If you consistently lose and you don't make the postseason, your job's at stake. The job of a player is 100% meritocracy. If you don't deliver the numbers, your days in the NFL are numbered. There are 2 different measuring sticks for players and head coaches. Your job of a head coach involves managing upwards with your GM and your owners, managing sideways with the media, and managing downwards with your coaches, players, and staff. Your job of a player is to generate yards and points or prevent the other team from doing so. Coaches that manage downwards and get their coaches and players to get their teams into the postseason have a greater chance of remaining as head coaches, regardless of their upward management skills with their GMs and owners. Coaches that don't get their teams in the postseason are usually tighter with their real estate agents than they want to be. But here's my take on the facts. First of all, the smoking gun, Bill Belichick's texts. I would say that Bill Belichick's texts, as cringeworthy as they were, I'm not sure that's evidence of racial discrimination. The New York Giants are not his team. His apparent knowledge of head coaching hiring before it's official suggests a confidential connection that most outsiders are unaware of. Who hasn't accidentally texted someone thinking it was someone else? It's embarrassing, and it could end a relationship depending on, you know, how juicy it was. Now, I'm not going to offer any personal stories here, but certainly I've done it before, and I'm always embarrassed when I do it. And it's certainly more than once. Bill's confidence about the Giants' selection before they completed the interview process suggests, like in millions of job interviews, that the hiring manager has a favorite going into the process. Sometimes he or she have to go through the process because of policy. And here you've got the Rooney policy. But in most corporations, there are certain policies about who you have to interview. If something's on the job board and somebody puts in for that job, you have to interview them. So that in itself is a form of discrimination, but not illegal. I was a hiring manager from the age of 27 until I retired, and I had countless job interviews, some of which I had a going-in favorite because of maybe a relationship I had with this person or because of their work or education pedigree. Or maybe somebody, a boss, told me, you got to interview this person. I think this person is right for us. And on a few of those occasions, as I went through the interview process and talked to other candidates that I was just, let's say I was just checking a box, I might have been overwhelmed by the candidates and what they had to offer. And I changed my hiring strategy and let that favorite go and chose the dark horse. So in this situation, Flores might not have been the favorite candidate for the Denver job or the New York job. He might also come across in a way that a GM or owner doesn't envision him as their guy to lead the team and portray their culture. Now, that could also have some racial undertones, but I think that's going to be challenging to prove in court. Now, I'm not saying it's not real. It could be real. A lot of these things can be true. I think Flores' first battle is going to be avoiding arbitration, which I believe is the NFL's way of protecting themselves and keeping the whole thing out of court. And in this case, not only does Brian claim racial discrimination in the NFL's hiring practices for head coaches, he's claiming strategic tanking of games with financial incentives for coaches. The overall prize of landing first and second round draft picks is measurable. It's measurable as it pertains to projected winning and total franchise value. So from that standpoint, I think the lid on Pandora's box has just been blown open. Whoopi Goldberg, you gotta be kidding me.
Whoopi Goldberg has been suspended for 2 weeks from The View following this controversial comment she made on Monday's episode.
And let's be truthful about it, because the Holocaust isn't about race. It's about man's inhumanity to man.
Last week, I spoke about how the school board from McMinn County in Tennessee banned the book Mouse, a Pulitzer Prize-winning illustrated book about the Holocaust. And so it comes up on the daily TV show The View. And then Whoopi, and I'm sure she didn't try and mean anything damaging, but it's like a lot of people that I've been exposed to, particularly when I used to work in corporate life, you'd get into these meetings and everybody's trying to decide how to solve a problem. And then you always get that one guy in the meeting who comes across as they are the smartest person in the meeting. And they're going to tell you what that's not the issue, what the real issue is. And then they're going to help you understand what the true core problem is so that you could solve it. And sometimes they're right. But in many cases, it's people just trying to hear themselves speak, or they just have a point of view that is not helping to solve the problem. In this case with Whoopi, she decided she was going to be the smartest person in the room and sum up the overlying issue of the Holocaust. She said it's not about race, and I think she said it multiple times. It's about man being horrible to man. And I think she repeated herself just so she could hear herself talk. And then she said, it's white people killing white people. Now, I admire that somebody has the right to defend their First Amendment rights and just speak out the way they want to speak out. A lot of times when I really haven't thought something out and my brain is slower than my mouth, I find that I risk consequences. I mean, how many times have we said things at a dinner party? Too quickly, maybe full of emotion, maybe after a few drinks, and our significant other or spouse gave us that look or kicked us under the table. I think, sometimes you get those laser beams like deeper than that character Homelander on The Boys. But there are consequences for actions. I just think Whoopi really didn't think it out, or maybe she doesn't know history. Back in 1919, Adolf Hitler characterized the Jews not as a religious community. He called the Jews a race tuberculosis, and these are people that had to be eradicated. They are a race. Now, whether or not you believe that a religion can be a race really doesn't matter. The fact is that the person that characterized them as a race and then tried to eradicate them became the issue of the Holocaust. And so, again, Whoopi is a proud black woman who just went through Black Lives Matter, or I should say has been living Black Lives Matter and dealing with being black in America, and saw that as a major race fight. And so maybe she didn't see this the same way. But again, every action and everything you say, particularly when you're on television, has consequences. Whoopi is clearly not a historian. She's a comedian and entertainer. And, sometimes it's hard to take a comedian seriously, particularly when they've established themselves as a comedian. I'm not giving her a pass, and she's apologized. And is this just another more evidence of cancel culture, where we tend to have to apologize for half the shit we say? Maybe. Maybe not. When it comes to the intended eradication of a race or religion, I just suggest you tread lightly. A fight at the Golden Corral? In Bensalem, Pennsylvania, at a Golden Corral, a major fight erupted after a man cut in line to grab the last piece of steak while the person in front of them was indecisive about what to put on their plate. Now, before I get into the details, I mean, I don't know if you're as impatient as I am, but whenever I go on these buffet lines and there's that one person that's sitting there looking for the perfect piece of broccoli or the carrot that's the perfect size, and they're just taking forever. Meanwhile, people are hungry. And when people are hungry on a buffet line, they get hangry. So I get what it's like to be impatient. But in this situation, this person cuts in line, gets the last piece of steak, and everybody goes apeshit. 40 people were caught on camera throwing punches, chairs, baby high chairs were being flung, and you could see it. People were pulling their phones out. Those that weren't fighting were filming, all because the restaurant ran out of steak. Now, imagine if this happened in a vegan restaurant. I mean, there'd be hacky sacks flying all over the room. And here's the last bit of news or noise, particularly for you, or I should say us, impatient golfers. This week, Neil Young pulls his music from Spotify to protest the number one podcaster, Joe Rogan, for talking about anti-vaxxing during this COVID era. After he does that, more artists start to jump on the bandwagon. Graham Nash, India Arie, they join Joni Mitchell and Nils Lofgren in protest of Joe's speech. You know, it's funny to me how artists create music freely with a moderate filter on their lyrics. I mean, you still can't use George Carlin's 7 dirty words, but you could sing about them, quite frankly, or just about any topic that doesn't create a riot. But when the highest paid podcaster talks about anti-vaxxing or covers racially sensitive topics, perhaps using the N-word too freely as a white person, it's a call to action to take your ball and go home. I'm not a proponent of anti-vaxxing. You know, I trust scientists in white coats that dedicate their lives to solving cures against diseases and viruses. I don't recall acing my chemistry or advanced calculus classes, but I do recall the students that did. Some of them went on to medical research, and I trust their aptitude to solve problems that most of us just can't or don't have the patience to. If they've collectively developed a vaccine that gives ourselves instructions to build these T or B lymphocytes and antibodies to fight viruses, I'm willing to give it a try. I'm not that bold to believe that my seemingly healthy body can create its own antibodies to do the same. It's like the vaccine gives ourselves these cliff notes to fight certain potential viral attacks, and who doesn't like cliff notes? But I'm not jumping on the fuck Joe Rogan bandwagon anytime soon. My podcast is ubiquitous and could be found on just about every streaming service. If Joe wants to exercise his First Amendment rights, he can do it. And again, he's apologized because I think he apologized because it became a money issue. The $100 million that Spotify is paying to him, there are certain things he can and can't do. And maybe he colored outside the lines. But again, I'm certainly not pulling my podcast because Joe's exercising his First Amendment rights. And you have to consider the source. Joe Rogan was a stand-up comedian. He's an entertainer, and he is a fight aficionado. Nowhere in his resume does it show that he's a scientist. So if you're going to listen to Joe and he gets off the topic of fighting or comedy and he gets into his what he believes is right for science and the human body, you got to consider the source. Which do you watch, the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am or the PIF Saudi Arabian International? Because now they're competing with each other for eyeballs, sound, and money. I happen to have some free time this weekend, so I ended up watching a little bit of both tournaments. First, the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. When I went to turn this on, I hadn't done a lot of research on the PIF, which I'll talk about in a second. So I'm anticipating it's going to be the same tournament, other than last year's where they couldn't have the amateurs play because of COVID rules. I'm anticipating it's going to be the same type of event. Top players in the world, top celebrities, and some big business CEOs and owners. And it's fun to watch, first of all. I love Pebble Beach. I've played Pebble Beach several times. To me, it's been my number one course to play. Not only the layout, but just being on the Pacific Ocean. And when you play some of these ocean holes, I mean, it's just beautiful. And there are people walking on the beach with their dogs. It's a different type of golf experience. So because I know the golf experience, when I watch it, I recall how I did on certain holes, which does not resemble what the pros did. But I remember the holes. So it has a place in my memory and a place in my heart. So this year, I go to turn it on, and most of the top players aren't there. And so I'm sure most of you listening to this knew that. So there's this new PIF league, Public Investment Fund, with Commissioner Greg Norman, who's been trying to carve out a special tour of top players, kind of like an all-star league, because he believes there is just way more money involved when you want to see the best players. So I turn on Pebble Thursday and Friday, and those are fun days because they tend to highlight more celebrities during those days. Once you get to Sunday, it's basically the pros trying to win the tournament. But up until then, you get some entertainment, and I didn't see as many celebrities as I remember seeing in past years. What I did see is a lot of CEOs because they're footing the bill. But so I'm watching Pebble and I'm like, what? Okay, where did everybody go? So I did a little research and I could see now you've got this PIF Saudi International. It attracted 21 of the top 50 A-list international golfers with lucrative appearance fees. The appearance fees are rumored to be between $2 million to $10 million just to show up and play in the event. PGA does not pay appearance fees. Through last weekend, the PGA had played 16 events. And so far, the number one prize money earner, Hideki Matsuyama, has earned $3.6 million. And then the number eighth player, Rory McIlroy, has earned $1.7 million. And he had to win an event to do that. 15 events. Now, you show up at the PIF, and you're invited to play, and you're getting between $2 and $10 million for one event. So you could see clearly what the attraction is for a player to show up. And so now, is this league going to start luring some of our bigger players? It's hard to say no to the money. Lee Westwood of the European Tour made a perceptive remark about the new tour. He says, it's like a game of poker where the DP Tour, formerly known as the European Tour, and the PGA have had the most chips at the table. Now the PIF has come to the table with even more chips than both of them. It's all about the money.
Show me the money.
Show me the money!
Congratulations, you're still my agent.
So now the top players are being lured to play for huge guaranteed payouts. So I'm interested. So I watched some of the PIF Saudi Arabian International. And while more A-listers were playing in the event, than the AT&T at Pebble, I found myself way more interested in watching Pebble Beach. Number one, as I said, the course means a lot to me. Watching that course, watching people play on that course, it just brings back memories. And the course is very cool. The setting is incredible. If you like a coast, and I was brought up on the East Coast. I lived on the West Coast for a long time, and I'm back on the East Coast again. I like living by the coasts. And so I enjoy a golf course on the coast. So now I compare that to the Saudi Arabian International. First of all, the course, not as attractive. I mean, when you look, when the cameras pan away from a green or a tee box and you see the environment, it's like sand, desert, some green areas. And I've played some desert golf before, but this looked particularly unattractive to me. In the background, you could probably see some infrastructure in some buildings, and that's like miles and miles away. But it looks barren because it's a desert. And then to make matters artistically worse, in the transition areas, now transition areas are almost like sand traps, except there are no rakes. And it's basically the ground around the golf course. In those areas, they're plopping down these promotional signs. They're sponsorship signs. It almost looks like you're going to a local sponsored event at a golf course where they're putting up, you know, Joe's Plumbing, you know, whatever it was. You just see the signs. They don't look as professional. And in the background of the sandy area, it wasn't as attractive as watching Pebble Beach. So just, you know, from eyeballing it, didn't look as good. And there are no trees there, and it was pretty windy. So now it looked kind of like a sandstorm while they're playing. Their announcers were international announcers, but they weren't the sound that I've become used to on weekends listening to the PGA. So then I turn it back to Pebble. It's Nick Faldo. On Sunday, it's Jim Nance. It's Dottie Pepper, Frank Nobilo, John Cook, Rich Lerner, and this guy, Aaron Oberholzer, who just sounds like a dude off the streets who's commentating. His lexicon is a lot different than the other announcers, but I like him, because he's played and he's played with the best. And so he kind of gets it. And so then you look at the players, and even though they had top players, only a few of them were at the PIF, were at the top of the leaderboard. And they showed Phil for a while, and he had hopes until he gets to this one hole. And, you know, Phil looked like a 52-year-old player playing with 30-year-old players. It happens. It happens to all of us. So now it's just not as exciting to watch. It doesn't sound the same. They don't have the same music. Also, when you watch Pebble Beach, the production value is far greater. They've been doing it for so long, and they have certain sound bites that they use and certain music that they use, and it just makes the production much better. And I remember when I was a kid, I hated watching golf. When I was a kid, it was Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus. It started off black and white, became, you know, I'm dating myself, but it's what I saw. And I hated it. It was boring. Today, it's not as boring. The technology of production value in the United States for the PGA is far different. And then you get to watching certain players. Jordan Spieth, I'm a Jordan Spieth fan, and I'm a fan of the way he conducts himself, the way he plays the game, and the fact that he's lost his game, found it. Happens to every golfer. But watching him on Saturday, on the eighth hole, which I've played many times, I don't ever remember parring it, but it's a short hole that is almost cut in half by this barranca, by this cliff, where you have to, once you hit your drive, and most of them are hitting irons, you now have to hit this 170, 180-yard shot over a cliff to the next part of the golf course. There's really no other way of scoring there without going over the cliff. I have, in all of the years playing there and all of the years watching, I've never seen a player drive their ball to the edge of the cliff. That means they're hitting it through the fairway, and it goes past the fairway, and if you hit it too far, it goes down in the cliff. You got to take a penalty and move back. Jordan Spieth hits a drive, I want to say 6 inches from the edge of this cliff, and those 6 inches were actually pointing down towards the beach. It wasn't a flat lie. He had to get up, and when he hit his shot, he is now, his left foot is standing at the edge of the cliff. And now he's got to hit this 175, 180-yard shot. Typically, pros, when they're hitting golf shots, their body weight goes from their back foot to their front foot, and then they're kind of standing up on their front foot. And so that's the way to hit a perfect golf shot. He can't do that here. And so all the announcers are thinking, you know, one of two bad things are going to happen. One is he leans back when he's hitting it and he just shoots his ball down the cliff. Now he's got to take a penalty shot. Or worse is he slips and he puts his weight too far forward and he falls down into that cliff. And if he fell into that cliff, that would have been his last swing of his life, maybe even his last breath. Again, we've never seen this ever on the PGA, and now he does it. He actually hits a shot, goes up over the green, lands on the back, he chips up and makes the par putt. And he goes on for the rest of the tournament, leading all the way up to the 17th hole on Sunday, where, I mean, he's been hitting some very pure shots, and he's been making some putts, and you just feel this is going to be his event, right? He's won here before. He's won big here before. And so this is his event. But he screws up 17, bogeys the hole. Meanwhile, he's got this guy, Hoagie, behind him, who is just playing out of his mind and ends up winning the tournament. But it was exciting. The drama was exciting. The last hour of that tournament was exciting. And it's always exciting coming up to the 18th hole because there's ocean on the left-hand side and there's this big pine tree in the middle of the fairway. And there's so many bad things that could happen. So you want to see, is somebody going to make a miraculous shot or is somebody going to dump it in the ocean? So yeah, for me, watching Pebble was so more far interesting than watching PIF. And we got a little bit of Bill Murray. We got a little bit of Alfonso doing the Carlton. And so so we saw a few celebrities, certainly not as many. I think we see more celebrities in the summertime when they play in Lake Tahoe and you have that celebrity event. It's all celebs. And then that's fun to watch because then you get to see sports professionals that are not professionals in golf playing golf, and some are shooting under par. Some players that are still playing in their sports, like Steph, play outstanding golf. So it's kind of fun, and then they entertain the crowds well. So I think unless they start attracting more celebrities back to Pebble Beach and it becomes like a CEO frenzy, I think the time to see them is in the summer at Lake Tahoe. So, you know, in summary and comparing the events, the Saudi Arabian International was unattractive. It was an unattractive event. And the production value, in my mind, was for all of this money being thrown in this league, it was underwhelming with announcers that were void of personality. Despite the fact that they got the talent, it was like watching a Netflix movie, like the movie Don't Look Up. All that great talent with just horrible writing and a horrible plot. They overpromised, and I think they underdelivered. A round of golf with Billy the Kid.
Yeehaw!
I've played a dozen rounds with this character I call Billy the Kid. Most of the time, we're competing against each other, except on some Saturday events where we play as a team in a foursome. So I walk out on the course last Tuesday after a two-week layoff, and I really hadn't played for almost a month. That horrible COVID thing really wipes you out. When I was living in Chicago, my golf clubs would be stored in the garage for at least 5 months when November 1st hit. It would take me until late June to refine my game after a long layoff. When I finally made the move to come down to South Carolina and live on the coast, I found that you could play golf just about every week of the year. During the winter months, there's at least one, if not 2 days a week, where it breaks 50 and you could either get out and practice, play your free holes, or even get out and play a round of golf. When I come back from a layoff, I just can't go out and play 18 holes without either practicing or having a day or so where I go out and play by myself, and when I hit a bad shot, throw another ball down, hit another one. I even, a few months ago, I had a day where I was trying to decide which tee boxes are really the most appropriate for me, and do I favor a white or yellow ball? So I actually played two balls, and I had A Rich and B Rich, and from the white tees, and I guess it's like 6,450 yards, I played a white ball. And then from the yellow tee boxes, which is a little under 6,000 yards, I played a yellow ball. And at the end of the day, you'd expect the yellows, which are a lot shorter, that the score would be better. And it was by a few shots. But what I found is I really liked playing a yellow ball, particularly in the winter months. Yellow is so much easier to see once you've hit it than a white ball is, particularly because the leaves that are falling and the grass starts to become dormant. And so white is just not as noticeable. So yeah, so from now on, I'm playing yellow balls. So anyway, I go out the other day and I was just planning one of those days again where I'm just going to go out and play multiple balls, yellow balls this time, and play from the yellow tee boxes. And as I get, the first tee was filled, and the starter, who's a friend of mine, said, "Hey, look, nobody's on the back. And by the way, Billy the Kid is teeing off on 10. So I shot over there, and he invited me to play with him. And so here's an opportunity. And he was, by the way, he was doing the same thing. He might not have had his best round the other day, or he had a great round and he wanted to figure out what he was doing so well so he could repeat it again. Either way, he was going out to play one or two balls, and he was going to drop a ball every time he missed a shot. So we both decided to do the same. A buddy of mine that I play golf with that I talked about a few episodes ago, Dick Drews from Berkeley Country Club, told me the way that he got better is by playing with better golfers. It just makes you better. You get to pick their brain, find out how they think about certain things, what they do in certain situations. And if that makes sense to you, you could actually make that part of your arsenal. So I decided this would be a good experience for me. I hope it was as good experience for Billy the Kid, because I'm not sure you get better when you play with somebody that's not as good as you. So like I've talked about in the past, you don't want to talk too much in the course of play. You rather wait on tee boxes and times when you have some idle time to have discussions. But in this situation, there was nobody in front of us, and Billy and I were just shooting through the hole. So anytime I could ask him a question where it seemed like it was the right time, certainly not in the middle of a swing, I would do it. Like, why does he use driving irons on certain holes instead of using his driver? How does he handle certain pitch and chip shots? This guy is like a Houdini when it comes to getting himself out of bad lies. That's why he always includes junk when he bets and he's playing a betting game. He's confident that he could just about save par from almost any lie on the golf course. So why not add an additional wager, you know, you're playing a $5 Nassau. Why not add a buck every time you could par a hole from junk or you could birdie a hole? Because that's just something that he does all the time. And I've played golf with hundreds of guys that on occasion will make a sand save, or they might roll in a birdie putt here and there. Of all these guys and gals, Billy's more likely to save par from almost any bunker. He's more likely to chip in birdies from unlikely spots and most likely to make birdie putts that snake the entire length of the green. If confidence were people, Billy would be China. As I continue to play with Billy and watch him, I realize that other than technique and experience, the belief that you can and will do something is the engine that powers the machine. So it brings up the question, which comes first? The experience of witnessing yourself perform under high-pressure situation, which builds confidence, or believing you're likely to do something followed by outstanding performance? Billy believes that he's done it before countless times, therefore he could do it again. When he goes to putt, he walks up and looks at the distance between where his ball is and where the cup is. He figures out the cant, the angle of the green, so which way is his ball going to go, right to left or left to right. And he puts that in his head, and when he gets up to his ball, he finds some kind of mark on the green that is along this path that he has already constructed in his mind. And all he does is he looks at that spot, looks back at the ball, and he's thinking about hitting that spot while making perfect contact with the face of his putter. So he's not thinking about the hole anymore. He's not thinking about the right to left or the left to right or the downhill or the uphill. He's already done that in his mind. All he does is think about making square contact with the middle of his putter face to push the ball over that mark. Whether it's putting, hitting a drive, or hitting a fairway iron, it comes down to this. If at any time you don't think you could make a shot, then you're most likely correct. Without a total commitment to a shot, without the belief that it's going to hit your target, you're likely to tense up. If it's hitting a long shot, it's shortening your backswing, hitting it fat, hitting it thin, blocking it or hooking it. If it's putting, it's pushing or pulling your putter, because that slight bit of indecision translates to unintended results. So after playing 18 holes of a practice round with Billy, again, it confirms in my mind that if you want to get better, you got to practice, you got to play with people that are better than you, and you have to believe that you can do something, and then just go do it. And if you do all of that and you misfire, do it again. You've been listening to another episode from Tales from the First Tee. I'm your host, Rich Easton, telling tales from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina.